from Pacifica Network. This is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from the DNC in Boston, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency.
I will be a commander-in-chief who will never mislead us into war. I will have a vice president who will not conduct secret meetings with polluters to rewrite our environmental laws. I will have a Secretary of Defense who will listen to the advice of the military leaders, and I will appoint an Attorney General who will uphold the Constitution of the United States.
John Kerry accepting his presidential nomination. Hours earlier, Pakistan announced a high-profile Al-Qaeda arrest 4 days after it happened. Is this the July surprise to upstage the Kerry nomination? We'll speak with a New Republic reporter who first broke the story. And then, as John Kerry cashes in on the anti-war sentiments of the country, some say it was the Clinton administration that set the tone for the invasion of Iraq. Democracy Now! Confronts Madeleine Albright on her statement that the deaths of 500,000 Iraqis was worth the price. We'll also hear from Governor Bill Richardson and Kwesi Mfume of the NAACP, as well as protests in the streets. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. Here are some of the headlines. I'm John Kerry, and I'm reporting for duty. That's how John Kerry opened his 55-minute speech last night, where he was officially accepting the Democratic nomination for president. He vowed to help make America stronger and to restore the country's credibility. Though not invoking their names, he clearly attacked Vice President Dick Cheney, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and Attorney General John Ashcroft. On Ashcroft, he said, quote, "I will appoint an Attorney General who actually upholds the Constitution of the United States." He also took a jab at the Bush administration's close ties to Saudi Arabia. He said, quote, "I want an America that relies on its own ingenuity and innovation, not the Saudi royal family." We'll hear part of John Kerry's address in just a few minutes. In other news, the Pakistani Interior Minister has announced a top member of Al-Qaeda has been captured in central Pakistan. Ahmed Kalfani Galani was on the FBI's most wanted list in connection with the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. This marks the most significant Al-Qaeda arrest since September 11th. Mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was detained over a year ago. Although Gailani was arrested on Sunday, Pakistan didn't announce his arrest until Thursday, the same day as John Kerry's acceptance speech. The arrest appears to confirm the explosive article titled July Surprise that appeared earlier this month in The New Republic. The article charged the Bush administration has been pressuring Pakistan to deliver a so-called high-value target before November, ideally during the Democratic National Convention, in order to eclipse John Kerry's moment in the national and international spotlight. The New York Times reporting the Census Bureau secretly gave the Department of Homeland Security detailed information on how many people of Arab background live in certain zip codes. One list provided a breakdown of Arab American populations sorted by country of origin in each zip code. Another set listed every city that had a population of more than 1,000 Arab Americans. The Department of Homeland Security claimed the information was not used for law enforcement purposes, but to help the agency determine which airports to post signs in Arabic. The Times reports the Census Bureau broke no laws as long as they did not identify any individuals. During World War II, the Census Bureau shared information about Japanese Americans, which helped federal officials round up people for internment camps. A former Census director, Kenneth Pruitt, criticized the decision to share the information about Arab Americans. He said, quote, in World War II, we violated our principles, even if we didn't violate the law, and we assured people we wouldn't do it again, he said. USA Today is reporting the Marine Corps has opened an inquiry to determine if Marine Lance Corporal Abdul Henderson should be disciplined for appearance in Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11. In the film, Henderson says he will refuse to return to fight in Iraq. His unit is facing a possible fall return to Iraq. A new audit by the U.S. government has found that the Coalition Provisional Authority cannot account for nearly $1 billion of Iraqi revenue that was supposed to be spent on reconstruction projects. The report marks the first formal audit of contracting procedures for the now disbanded CPA. In news from Iraq, a major political convention scheduled for this weekend has been postponed. The convention, which was to gather 1,000 delegates, was being billed as a key step toward democracy in Iraq. The convention's been postponed for 2 weeks, in part because of the ongoing violence in Iraq and because of debates over the makeup of the delegates. Delegates at the convention will select 100 members of a national assembly that will serve as an interim legislature until national elections are held. Meanwhile, Iraq's unelected Prime Minister Alawi yesterday expressed support for a Saudi plan to form an international Muslim security force to serve in Iraq. Earlier today, Secretary of State General Colin Powell made a surprise visit to Iraq, meeting with Iraq's unelected President Ghazi al-Yawar and U.S. Ambassador John Negroponte. Yesterday, Powell met with Prime Minister Alawi in Saudi Arabia. And in New York, the police department has put on trial an officer who refused to arrest a homeless man sleeping in a parking garage. If found guilty, the officer, Eduardo de la Cruz, could be fired. This is Democracy Now! Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency. Yes, broadcasting from Cambridge Community Television, a wonderful collaboration this week in Cambridge, the unconventional city, just across the river from the Democratic National Convention in Boston. John Kerry accepted the Democratic presidential nomination on Thursday, the closing night of the party's national convention. Speaking before a jam-packed audience at the Fleet Center, Kerry formalized his candidacy in a 55-minute address dominated by foreign affairs and national security. The New York Times described the address as a, quote, striking contrast to Democratic acceptance speeches going back a generation. In his speech, Kerry said he would increase military spending to expand the armed forces by 40,000 active duty troops. In the lead up to his address, speaker after speaker offered personal testimonials to Kerry, from fellow veterans in Vietnam to U.S. senators, as well as his two daughters, Vanessa and Alexandra. A 9-minute biographic documentary of Kerry, made with the help of Steven Spielberg, narrated by Morgan Freeman, showed grainy images of a nominee as a young soldier in Vietnam, followed by his anti-war testimony before the Senate in 1971. After being introduced by former Senator Max Cleland, Kerry strode into the convention hall, packed shoulder to shoulder with delegates and other Democrats. He began his primetime address by saluting the audience and saying, quote, I'm John Kerry, I'm reporting for duty. His address brought the carefully controlled and highly scripted 44th Democratic Convention to a close last night. The Republican National Convention will take place in New York at the end of the month. Here is a short excerpt of what the Democratic presidential nominee, John Kerry, had to say.
I will be a commander-in-chief who will never mislead us into war. I will have a vice president who will not conduct secret meetings with polluters to rewrite our environmental laws. I will have a Secretary of Defense who will listen to the advice of the military leaders, and I will appoint an Attorney General who will uphold the Constitution of the United States. Americans, this is the most important election of our lifetime. The stakes are high. We are a nation at war, a global war on terror against an enemy unlike we've ever known before. And here at home, wages are falling, healthcare costs are rising, and our great middle class is shrinking. People are working weekends, two jobs, three jobs, and they're still not getting ahead. We're told that outsourcing jobs is good for America. We're told that jobs that pay $9,000 less than the jobs that have been lost is the best that we can do. They say this is the best economy that we've ever had. And they say anyone who thinks otherwise is a pessimist. Well, here is our answer. There is nothing more pessimistic than saying that America can't do better. And we will. We're the optimists. For us, this is a country of the future. We're the can-do people. And let's not forget what we did in the 1990s. We balanced the budget. We paid down the debt. We created 23 million new jobs. We lifted millions out of poverty. And we lifted the standard of living for the middle class. We just need to believe in ourselves, and we can do it again. So tonight, so tonight in the city where America's freedom began, only a few blocks from where the Sons and Daughters of Liberty gave birth to our nation, here tonight, on behalf of a new birth of freedom, on behalf of the middle class who deserve a champion and those struggling to join it who deserve a fair shot, for the brave men and women in uniform who risk their lives and for their families who pray for their return, for all those who believe that our best days are ahead of us with great faith in the American people, I accept your nomination for President of the United States.
John Kerry delivering his acceptance speech at the Democratic National Convention in Boston last night. Just hours before his address, Pakistan announced the arrest of a top al-Qaeda suspect that made headline news across the world. The man, Ahmed Khalfan Gailani, key suspect in the 98 bombings of two U.S. embassies in East Africa that killed more than 200 people, including 12 U.S. citizens. He's the most senior al-Qaeda operative caught in Pakistan since the arrest in March 2003 of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the suspected mastermind of the September 11th attacks. The timing of the disclosure may rekindle controversy surrounding an earlier report alleging White House pressure on Pakistan to produce a high-value target in July when the Democratic Convention was to kick off. Pakistani officials say Gailani was captured last Sunday during a 14-hour gun battle in the town of Gujarat. Gailani was on the FBI's list of 22 most wanted terrorists after being indicted in New York over the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. A reward of up to $25 million had been offered by the U.S. for his capture, the same bounty offered for Osama bin Laden. It remains unclear how long Pakistani authorities knew Gailani's identity before releasing the news 4 days after apprehending him. In the July 19th edition of The New Republic, several unnamed Pakistani security officials said the Bush administration had privately been bearing down on the Pakistani government to capture Osama bin Laden his deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri or the Taliban's mullah Mohammed Omar before U.S. elections in November. One source in the report said a White House aide suggested to Pakistan's intelligence chief that the first 3 days of the Democratic National Convention would be the, quote, best timing. We're joined now on the telephone by John Judas, senior editor at The New Republic, author of the article Pakistan for Bush, July Surprise. Welcome to Democracy Now!'s Breaking with Convention, John.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about this latest development?
Well, the latest development pretty much confirms what we wrote in the article, which is that there was pressure to have for Pakistan to produce a high-value target during the last 10 days of July and to announce that arrest. What our source said to us was it would be best if the arrest or killing of any high-value target were announced on 26, 27, or 28 July, which is the first 3 days. So it was announced on the fourth day. And so the question is, why then? And already there's some questions that I've seen raised from intelligence officials here, because you have basically two possibilities. One is that they held the guy for several days before making the announcement on Thursday. So why, after having captured him on Sunday, did they announce it then? But you have an even more interesting question raised of why they announced it at all, because when you have somebody who's been in hiding since 1998, they have an enormous amount of information and contacts. And by announcing this guy's arrest, what you do is you warn off everybody who's been associated with him from the last 5 or 6 years, and you tell them that they better get their act together or they're going to be found. So there's not really a lot of question of why they announced this thing when they did.
Can you talk about how you learned of this story and what your contacts are saying right now? Yesterday, headlines around the world upstaging the Kerry nomination.
Well, we learned this story from diverse sources in the Pakistani government. We had two contacts in the ISI, the equivalent of the American CIA. We had another contact in the Interior Ministry, which is the in charge of internal security and which announced the arrest. And we had another contact who was a top general. We're going back to them right now in preparation for a story next week. So I can't discuss yet what we're going to find out. But I think the reason we got this story was that the Pakistanis were irritated that they were getting this kind of pressure to produce at a certain date, mostly because what that entailed was going into these tribal areas in the north and possibly precipitating a kind of civil war.
John Judas, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I think what I'd like to add is I'd like to see this question turn not so much on were we right, but what's the Bush administration really up to, and are they politicizing foreign policy to a degree that we really haven't seen since the Nixon years?
Would you say it's fair to say, for those who might say it is not bad to capture these high-value targets, that it's not so much that they pushed to speed up the process, but perhaps put it off?
Well, yes, and it's a question of politics. Politics is supposed to end at the water's edge, and when it intrudes in foreign policy, you get decisions that don't necessarily reflect the national interest, but simply reflect the interest of a particular party or individual wanting to make wanting to win an election. Sometimes that can coincide with what everybody wants, but sometimes it can't. And it may be in this case that we and the Pakistanis got somebody and prematurely announced this person's arrest in order to have an electoral impact.
John Judas, I want to thank you very much for being with us, senior editor at The New Republic, author of the article, Pakistan for Bush, July surprise. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to the streets outside the Fleet Center. Yesterday, hundreds of protesters faced off with riot police. Stay with us.
Vote for Mr. Rhythm. Raise up your voice and vote for Mr. Rhythm, the people's choice. You'll be happy with them. Take my advice and vote for Mr. Rhythm. I'm voting twice. Everyone's a friend of his. His campaign slogan is change your woe into a woody hole. Vote for Mr. Rhythm. Let freedom ring and soon we'll all be singing of the I swing. Now when I say vote for Mr. Rhythm, you all know I mean Chick Webb. That's all my friends I came to state. But now listen to a noble candidate.
This is Democracy Now!, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast just across the river from the Democratic National Convention at Cambridge Community Television in the unconventional city. On the last day of the Democratic National Convention Thursday, several hundred protesters wound through downtown Boston, stopped at the iron gates guarding the DNC. They refused to go to the police-sanctioned protest pen, which is enclosed in barbed wire fencing with razor wire above. Demonstrators from the group Black Tea Society began the protest near Copley Square at midday. The protesters eventually wound up near the Fleet Center, where they set fire to a two-faced effigy of President Bush and Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry. The protesters faced off with an equal number of police and other security personnel one block from where the delegates were entering the convention. At least three protesters were arrested by police in full riot gear. We came upon the scene as the police were dragging a young man down the road. Another protester was slammed to the ground. The city of Boston spent at least $50 million on security for the convention, mobilizing some 5,000 law enforcement officers from two dozen local, state, and federal agencies. Democracy Now! Is at the scene of the protest at the gates of the Fleet Center. We bring you the sounds and sights of the street.
Bring the troops home now! Bring the troops home now!
My name is Leslie Kagan. I'm the national coordinator of United for Peace and Justice. We're a national coalition, but we're here in Boston to send a message to John Kerry and the Democratic Party, an anti-war message. So we're here today with a number of Boston groups trying to do a rally on Canal Street. Canal Street is up against the so-called protest zone that the city set up. We originally were going to be in that zone, but when we got here last week and saw what the city had actually done in terms of fencing and barbed wire and patrols by the National Guard and everything else, we felt that actually going in that into that area, one, would not be very safe for people, but also it would actually be undermining our basic constitutional right to freely assemble. The Constitution doesn't say you have a right to assemble, it has a right to free assembly, and that's what we're trying to do here today. So we're here as close as we can get to where the delegates are entering into the last night of the convention.
I'm out here because I'm part of the Catholic Worker, and I think it's really important to remember why we're out here. Really, I think what gets lost in the political rhetoric and the anger is our inability as a country to grieve and to feel grief, and that this is all sad at a really basic human level, that what's happened to democracy, what's happened to state rights, but especially what's happened with war. So many people have died and suffered, including soldiers, Iraqis, Palestinians, Afghanis, the nation's poor. I think we need to reconsider how we're approaching the system. because the system is really hurting people at a basic human level. And if we continue to argue, capitalism is bad, or socialism is bad, or communism is bad, we forget. We get lost in our own egos, and we have to remember that the only thing that we can do as individuals is live out personally nonviolence and live out certain ideals that we believe. And I think that we have to disarm each other. We have to stop yelling at each other, cop versus protester, Democrat versus Republican. War is bad for everybody. Killing is wrong, you know. And I think that's why I'm out here. You know, this makes me so sad. This makes me sad. The pen makes me sad.
We cut the fence. We cut this big hole in the fence. We cut another hole down there. And our intention was to get as much of it down as possible. And the police came and took our bolt cutters and then walked away. So, I mean, the main point is that, and what I told the reporter earlier is that, you know, it's unfortunate that in America, when you have an important message, when you have a message about justice and liberty and freedoms, that you have to do something extreme to get any attention.
I'm out here because I hate the two-party system, the one-party system masquerading as a two-party system. And that's not democracy at all, and we need to show people that there's another form of democracy and how to do it.
I'm out here because I don't agree with what's going on, and I want to see something happen. So this is my chance to at least have a little bit of a voice of what's going
talk.
On.
We're trying to take an action towards things, you know?
Democrats and Republicans sold this country. They're selling this country right now in that building.
One of the participants in the march read from the Constitution, read the specific articles that explained and mandated that it's illegal for soldiers to be used on the American people or on the citizens, and we were here to respectfully request that they obey the law. We invited them and requested that in the name of the people that they stop breaking the law.
Your name?
Charles Shaw.
You're with?
I'm an organizer with the Green Party, and I'm chair of the Peace Action Committee.
Why are you out here today?
Ostensibly to try to keep some peace, demonstrate against the war, against the police state, the Patriot Act, the unfair trade policies, and the escalation that is surely to come under John Kerry's leadership should we be permitted a fair election and he actually get to win.
So what did you see happen?
Well, when we got down here, we had told them on Monday that we as a collective would not go into the pen, which is behind you. We refuse to be caged like animals. So with some direct negotiation with the upper level of the Boston Police Department, they allowed us to come down here right to the edge of the Fleet Center and protest against this 10-foot high wrought iron fence that they have here. We had came down again today in the exact same manner that we did Monday. Monday went off without a single incident. We came down here today to do it again. And a couple of the kids raised up an effigy of Bush and Kerry. They set it on fire. The police had no problem with this. Kids were dancing around the fire, having fun, and then randomly, out of the blue, a bunch of police who had snuck in from the backside grabbed a bunch of anarchist kids out of the crowd and tackled them.
It's a hoax device, but when the officer saw it, it appeared to be, to him, to be a Molotov cocktail. It's shaped like a bottle with a fuse in it.
So it's a protest statement?
No, it's a provocative act.
As it turned out, the protester was dressed as a pirate with a papier-mâché hook for an arm. That's what the commanding officer, Robert Dunford, was showing to reporters, though never said that. When I questioned the commanding officer of the entire security operation, Dunford, who was in the thick of the action against the protesters, about why the police had dragged this young man halfway down the street and saw another protester slam to the ground, he slammed my arm down as I was trying to record his response. Well, at about the same time, or just about an hour afterwards, Ohio Congress member and former presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich stepped up to an open mic where one of the speakouts was taking place just outside the Fleet Center, though not in the protest zone, since protesters have been protesting the zone for the entire week, and he addressed the crowd.
Are you ready to continue our efforts for peace and for social and economic justice in America and around the world?
Yeah.
Are you ready to continue our efforts to end the occupation of Iraq?
Yeah!
Are you ready to continue to stand up and insist that our troops be brought home?
Yeah!
I'm glad that you are, because I am too. And the message that I have for you today is continue your efforts. Never relent. We're going to change the policies of this country and help America take a new direction. But first, we have some business to do in November, and that is get rid of this president that took us into this war. Yes, and I need your help to do that. This is not going to be an easy election, but we have to know that the best chance we have as Americans is to make a new start. The best chance we have for peace is to make a new start. And I'm absolutely dedicated to helping make that new start by working for the election of John Kerry. John Kerry and I did not agree on the war. John Kerry and I did not agree on many of the issues, but I'm going to tell you something. Go ahead, have at it. And when you're done, I'll continue.
All right, here we go, Dennis.
9/11 was a setup, Dennis.
Let me know when you want me to continue. I want to let you know that it is our commitment, individually and collectively, that will take America in a new direction. That is a constant commitment that preceded this election, and it will follow this election. This is about not just the election of a president of the United States. This is about a shift of consciousness in America and the world. It's about our ability to be peacemakers. And our first lesson is to be able to be peacemakers while at the same time we understand the importance of being able to reconcile support for a candidate who represents the only hope that we have to take a new direction for American policy. I am proud to stand here as someone who continues to work with you to make sure that America stands for new directions. I was proud to lead the effort in the House of Representatives, and we were all right. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. Little Al-Qaeda's role in 9/11 had nothing to do with the anthrax attack, did not have weapons of mass destruction, was not trying to get uranium from Niger. In fact, there was no reason to go in. There's no reason to stay in. We need to continue to insist that we hold together a peace movement, but we're going to do it by moving into a White House where we have a president that'll be able to connect with the world community, not isolate the United States, work with the nations of the world, create a new context for peace in the world. This is what we have to work towards. This is what our goal should be. And then after the election, we're going to regroup and continue once again our effort to create a new world, to create a stronger peace, to create an enduring direction for a peaceful structure in the United States. I thank you for your commitment. I am here to sustain your commitment. I will work with you to continue your commitment. Ours is not just about an election. Ours is about creating a new America. Thank you.
Former Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich addressing a rally outside the convention center yesterday. Thousands of delegates, alternates, and journalists descended on the Fleet Center last night to hear John Kerry and the culmination of the Democratic National Convention accepting his nomination. Democracy Now! Is inside the Fleet Center to cover Kerry's speech, but the halls filled up quickly and security personnel shut off access to the convention center a full 3 hours before Kerry's address. Fire marshals, police, special forces, barred spectators, journalists, even elected delegates with the proper passes from getting up the escalators to the convention floor. Police forces then formed a line and forced people out of the building and onto the street. But one delegate from Oklahoma, standing at the foot of the escalator, quietly refused to leave.
I'm a delegate from the state of Oklahoma. I got a rightful seat up there.
Understand that,
so,
sir. Right now,
cuff me. I'll go to jail.
One officer told the delegate he would, quote, deal with him, and forced everyone outside the building. Minutes later, several police officers forced the elected Oklahoma delegate to the ground, face down, handcuffed him behind his back. We caught up with him as he was being taken out of the convention center area, a police officer on each arm.
You said you're a delegate?
I'm a delegate.
And what's happening? Are you under arrest?
I couldn't get in. They wouldn't let me in.
Why not?
I'm being arrested for trying to fill my seat. And I'm a delegate.
Where are you a delegate from?
I'm a delegate from the state of Oklahoma.
And were you elected?
I was elected, and I couldn't go up because there's too many special people that had special privileges other than I.
What do you mean by that?
Well, guest of congressman, special VIP that didn't have, that weren't elected, and I couldn't go up. And these guys arrested me for staying there.
Do you think it's worth being arrested?
I think it is.
Why?
I mean, it's too late now. I mean, they got cuffs on me and they won't let me go, so I'll do what I gotta do, and we'll go from there.
When you go back.
Oklahoma delegate being arrested as he tried to go up the stairs to, well, perform what he said was his elected duty to nominate the president from the Democratic Party, the Democratic presidential candidate. That scene from outside as he was arrested for refusing to leave the Fleet Center when fire marshals cleared the building after they say it got too crowded. Well, this week here in Boston, much of the focus of the discussion among the delegates on the floor is centered around opposition to the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And while the sentiments among the delegates are overwhelmingly anti-war and anti-occupation, that's not been reflected from the speaker's podium. In fact, both John Kerry and John Edwards gave speeches that could be characterized as pro-war. And while the Democratic base is anti-war, that's not been the record of John Kerry during his campaign. In fact, Kerry began his bid for the presidency running as a pro-war candidate. It was only after Howard Dean tapped into the anti-war sentiment that Kerry began adopting anti-war rhetoric. Some veteran Iraq observers say it was the Clinton administration that set the tone for the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq. It was Clinton who began the most sustained bombing campaign since Vietnam when, in 1998, he began almost daily attacks on Iraq in the so-called no-fly zone. And in 1998, Clinton's administration made so-called regime change in Iraq official U.S. policy. During his presidency, Bill Clinton presided over the most devastating regime of economic sanctions in history that the UN estimated took the lives of as many as 1 million Iraqis, the vast majority of them children. In May of 1996, 60 Minutes aired an interview with Madeleine Albright, who at the time was Clinton's UN ambassador. Correspondent Leslie Stahl said to Albright, quote, "We've heard 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children that died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?" Madeleine Albright replied, "I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it." Let's go to that tape for a minute.
"We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it? I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it."
Well, last night, as people filed out of the convention center after John Kerry's speech, we spotted Madeleine Albright.
Secretary Albright, the question I've always wanted to ask, do you regret having said, when asked, do you think the price was worth it?
I have said 5,000 times that I regret it. It was a stupid statement. I never should have made it. And if everybody else that has ever made a statement they regret would stand up, there'd be a lot of people standing. I have many, many times said it, and I wish the people would report that I have said it. I wrote it in my book that it was a stupid statement.
Do you think it laid the groundwork for later being able to target Iraq and make it more acceptable on the part of the Bush administration?
What? Are you got to be kidding.
Well, the sanctions against Iraq.
The sanctions against Iraq were put on because Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. But there never were sanctions against food and medicine. And you people need to know there never were sanctions against food and medicine. And I was responsible for getting food in there and getting Saddam Hussein to pump oil.
But as you know,
Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright speaking to us as she was leaving the convention center last night. After John Kerry's closing address, dozens of people remained in the Fleet Center arena. The floor was littered with confetti and signs. CNN host Larry King was broadcasting live from a stage on the convention floor. He hosted a roundtable discussion with guests, including political commentator Tucker Carlson, actor John Cusack, New Mexico governor and chair of the Democratic National Convention, Bill Richardson. We caught up with Governor Richardson after he finished his interview with Larry King. Governor Richardson, is Kerry foreign policy an escalation? I mean, he's talking about more troops in Iraq, and he's talking about supporting the Sharon policy of building the wall in the Middle East. I'm Amy Goodman with Democracy Now! Radio and Television.
No, Senator Kerry is an internationalist. He wants to operate our foreign policy with our alliances, with our allies, and not go it alone.
But he's talking about supporting the wall.
I'm really sorry. Please get that out of my way.
Well, while Governor Richardson refused to speak to us further, earlier in the day we caught up with the NAACP president, Kwaise Mfume, the former Congress member. After break, we'll go to our conversation with Kwaise Mfume. Stay with us.
I'm gonna let it shine, oh, this little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine,
let it shine,
this little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine,
this little light of mine.
I'm gonna let it shine, oh, this little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine,
let it shine.
Let it shine, let it shine,
oh, everywhere I go, Lord,
I'm gonna let it shine, oh, everywhere I go, Lord, I'm gonna
let it shine,
everywhere I go, Lord, I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
This little light of mine here on Democracy Now!, Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast from the end of the Democratic National Convention here in Boston. As people were filling their seats just before the main address of John Kerry last night, we caught up with Kwaise Mfume, president of the NAACP. Earlier this month, President Bush declined an invitation to speak at the NAACP's annual convention for the fourth year in a row. I asked President Mfume about President Bush.
Well, you know, the president made a tactical error. It's regrettable. He's the first president since Herbert Hoover to do something like that. And by his refusal to, in any way, not just this year, but over the last 4 years, wanting to interact with the nation's oldest and largest civil rights organization, you know, the animosity on both sides has only grown. It didn't get to this feverish pitch all of a sudden because he decided not to come this year. He's made a conscious decision that he's never wanted to meet, even though we write him twice a year, asking for 20 minutes of his time to talk about issues. He's never been to any of the conventions. And, you know, the question is whether or not he lied 4 years ago when, as a candidate, he came to our convention and talked about all the Republican Party had not done, but all that it would do if he were elected. And then he just got lost, at least in terms of us and in terms of a lot of members of the black community. I don't have anything against George Bush on a personal level. I think he's getting bad advice, and he's done more in this decision to energize the larger base of persons who probably would not have voted than anything I or anybody else could have done in our efforts to turn out voters. So it's something that I think has added to this anti-Bush fever that's running around the country, and I'm not saying everybody's infected with it, but I can tell you that there are a lot of people who just don't see him as a unifier. They see him as one who's quick to divide. And if his litmus test is to only talk to and meet with those who agree with you, then God help our country.
What about his going to the Urban League?
I think most people know that that was to sort of cover himself, because he had told the Urban League 2 weeks prior that he didn't have time, that he had schedule conflicts when he really didn't. And then after what happened at the NAACP conference, I think it was a face-saving attempt to at the last minute say, oh, by the way, we did find time, I'd like to come by. You know, a lot of voters out there who watch this, and some of them were born at night, they just weren't born last night. I think they can tell the difference between sincerity and finding a way to conveniently reach out in the 11th hour of one's presidency.
And so how is the NAACP mobilizing now for the election?
Well, we've been mobilizing all year. We've been concentrating about 27 states, making sure that we register unlikely voters and turn out unlikely voters, which are never counted by the pollsters, and to make sure that there is a process of political registration, political education, and then in November, political turnout. We had great success 4 years ago in increasing significantly the turnout of black voters nationwide. We hope to do that, if not to eclipse it this year.
And how do you stop Florida 2000 from happening again?
Well, one of the things that you have to do is to start early, and waiting for Election Day is not going to get it. We've already got attorneys on the ground throughout the state. It was the NAACP that filed suit against seven counties and the state of Florida within a month or so of the last election, and we held public hearings there. We're starting now to document.
And what came of that lawsuit?
Well, there was a huge legal ruling. There was a great deal of judicial relief that was set forward by the courts, a process which has already been violated, because a month or so ago I had to write the Attorney General urging him to have the state cease and desist from purging voters. They have purged, or up to that point had purged, 2,100 legally constitutionally approved voters whose rights had been restored by the state, and then somehow or another purged them again. And in this instance, it was being a matter of being having your hand caught in the cookie jar, and they said, oh, we're sorry, we apologize, you're absolutely right, these people are legal. So the best thing is on the front end of this process to document problems, to certainly bring about legal challenges, and to make sure that everybody is aware going into the election that there are more eyes than just a few watching.
The news made a big deal of Florida saying they weren't going to demand these felon lists. But in the end, it wasn't that they were saying they wouldn't do it. They were just saying they wouldn't make it mandatory. So if the voting supervisors wanted to use them, they could. That wasn't talked about.
Well, there's a lot that hasn't been talked about with Florida. It's a peculiar case. And it would have been refreshing if Jeb Bush had just stood up and said emphatically, we're never going to have this again in our state. We're going to do everything we can to comply, and we're going to meet every litmus test out there to ensure that the right to cast a vote and to have it counted is an American right that will be protected by the government of Florida. And I haven't heard that yet.
Do you see a conflict of interest between having the governor of Florida being the president of the brother of the president?
Well, I don't see a conflict of interest. He was duly elected, and then he was reelected. So somebody there wanted him in office. I think it puts a greater burden on him to say to people that we are free of any political foolishness, and a greater burden on Jeb Bush to lay out a process that he puts his word to that will, in fact, ensure people's right to be voted.
Very last question. The overwhelming number of delegates here, the overwhelming majority, are opposed to war and opposed to the USA Patriot Act. That is not what we're hearing from the vetted speeches on the platform for the most part, and certainly not in prime time. What is your response?
Well, that's why I went out on the floor and talked about this nonsense, number one, of attempting to build a democratic government in Baghdad without protecting democracy and democratic voters here at home. This nonsense about trying to find a way to not deal with the issue of choice, you know, one of the most personal decisions that a woman has to make. And I think it's a decision made between her and her God and not for her by her government. The issue of the minimum wage, but more importantly, a livable wage for working men and working women. Those are very dear issues to me, the right to have the process protected in terms of voting and the need to try to find a way to build a coalition of black people and white people and Latinos and Asians and Native Americans, and forget the hype, but to put together a coalition of real people who every day look at this country and all they want for it to be is better than the way they found it.
Kwasi Mfume, president of the NAACP, speaking from the Fleet Center as he was taking a seat to watch John Kerry accept his party's nomination for president of the United States. The Boston Police Department has begun random searches of public transport passengers during this week of the Democratic National Convention, provoking cries of outrage from civil rights advocates, saying these tactics have unfairly victimized immigrants, while at the same time the police have failed to respond to requests from these communities for protection from racial abuse. Prothap Chatterjee and Sakura Saunders have this report.
Ali Nurani of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition says that the police have used the Democratic National Convention to launch new anti-terrorism measures for the Boston Metro.
The MBTA police, the subway systems police, has decided to clamp down on people carrying bags during the convention. And they claim that that will make us safer because terrorists supposedly carry things in their bags that are going to hurt other people. Why they did this, we're not really sure, but in our eyes, it's not a very good security policy. They have been randomly searching bags of people on any of the lines, and they claim to be, you know, picking the 9th, the 10th, or the 11th person who's on the train with a bag, and to ask them to open their bags and, you know, kind of thumb through them with a flashlight. On the commuter rails, they're actually passing the bags through some kind of a bomb detection device. But the scary part is not only do they feel comfortable doing it now, but they feel like this is an appropriate security measure for the future. And we saw the same thing happening with special registration in terms of immigrants coming into the country from 14 different countries in the world. And the Fed said, you know, they're from this country, so therefore they are a security risk. In this case, you know, you're carrying a bag, so you're a security risk. If you're a security risk because you're carrying a bag, then check all the bags.
Meanwhile, the Boston police have ignored pleas for help from the Vietnamese community, which was recently terrorized by a group of white youth. James Buey is the program director for the Vietnamese American Community Center.
One incident that happened about 2 weeks ago in South Boston, in this housing project, located about 2 miles away from the main Vietnamese community center, which is Fields Corner. This incident involved approximately 50 youth, according to most newspapers out there. It was around teenage youth, mostly white, Irish, as well as Vietnamese. In this matter, a 16-year-old Vietnamese youth named Bang Mai was beaten to death with a baseball bat, supposedly by a white, Irish young male.
According to Ching-In Chen, director for the Asian American Resource Workshop here in Boston, the refusal by the police to investigate the killing of Bang Mai as a hate crime has shaken the community's trust to the judicial system.
Because they're not even tracking hate crimes, they don't even acknowledge that hate crimes exist in our community. And it's a huge problem because, you know, when the police have a real job to do, they're not doing it. They're not protecting this community from hate crimes. And they've never actually had people of color and communities of color in mind, you know, in terms of protection. And what we're saying is that not that we want more police or more law enforcement in our communities, but actually that we want real solutions to these problems. And one huge problem that results in hate crimes is racism. And we want real solutions to racism, which means that the government would put more of its resources into things that really matter to people, like better jobs, better health care, better schools and education, you know, less prisons and less criminalization of youth.
The Asian American Resource Workshop and the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition have launched initiatives to support immigrants and teach them their rights. Again, Ali Nurani.
Well, what we've counseled the immigrant community in Greater Boston to do is that if they are asked to be searched, to comply with that search, because the constitutionality of this is bunk. There's no question about that. But at the end of the day, we want to provide people the opportunity to get to their jobs. So we said, comply with the search, get out of the situation. The police have no right to ask you for identification, and if they harass you, call us.
For Democracy Now!, I'm Prothap Chatterjee with Sakura Saunders in Boston.
And we end this week's special coverage of the convention, Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency, where we began. And that is in the streets outside the Fleet Center. Earlier in the week, a major permitted rally against war, dealing with a number of issues, sponsored by the Answer Coalition. We brought you the story through an eyewitness of a man who was taken out of the peaceful protest and arrested, detained. Well, yesterday we caught up with the man himself, Vijay Singh, who told his story.
I was in the anti-war march, and I was pulled away by Secret Service and local police.
What were you doing at the time?
I was in the march, but when they pulled me away, forced me into an alley, and they specifically said they wanted to isolate me, they sat me down on some steps and handcuffed me. They were treating me like a criminal.
How did they grab you?
Two guys. I'm not sure about this, but a police officer was sort of distracting me with some small talk, like asking us what we believed in. I'm not sure if that was orchestrated or not, but immediately after, two guys. In a nutshell, what I just told you, you know, what I was against and what I, you know, why I was demonstrating and all that.
Was he in uniform?
Yes.
While you were walking, he was asking.
Yeah, and there were a few other people around too. And immediately after that, two law enforcement agents came and came up to my back and sort of held on to me and pushed me down this alley towards Faneuil Hall. And luckily, I was in shock. I mean, I thought almost it was a joke. I mean, that's how much disbelief I had. And luckily, I was able to like wave to some people, like turn and wave. I distinctly remember that image, you know, the signaling for help. And they pushed me down into this alley, and they immediately handcuffed me and sat me down on the step. And at that point, there were a lot of other police officers there too, Secret Service, and they told me why they were they snagged me, and it was because earlier that day, before the march, I was actually looking for the march because I came late. I was looking around. I walked to try to find the march, and I made my way down Washington Street and towards North Station. Towards the Fleet Center, and I was actually near where you were interviewing somebody, and I was just looking around and you know, looking at sort of the security zone, like tens and tens and hundreds, probably hundreds of other people were, that was what raised their suspicion. In fact, the exact phrase from the Secret Service spokeswoman was, acting weird or strange for an extended period of time.
Vijay Shah describing being detained by the Secret Service. And that does it for Breaking with Convention, broadcasting from Cambridge Community Television. So many people to thank. Jeremy Scahill coordinated our overall broadcast from the Convention Center. Mike Burke from our studios. Our producers also Sharif Abdelkaddous and Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Prothap Chatterjee, Sakura Saunders, Lee Burek, and Nell Geiser. Special thanks to Chris Zucker, Uri Galed, and to Matt O'Neill. The Cambridge Community Television team has been amazing. John Donovan, Dennis Dutra, Holly Gettings, James Barabas, Gordon Breyer, Daniel Cashin, Sean Clark, Sean Effel, Matt Landry, Evan Reagan, Vaughn Simpkins, Susan Fleischman, Diane Andronica, Corey Blamire, Shams Mirza, Steve Sillery, Ginny Berkowitz, David Zermeno, Erica Jones, Ellie Cow, Artman Martin. Produced at the studios of Cambridge Community Television, special thanks to the City of Cambridge, the unconventional city. And also tonight we'll be in Nantucket at the Unitarian Universalist Church. Hope to see listeners and viewers there. I'm Amy Goodman in this unprecedented broadcast.